Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday,
1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time,
and you're listening to the news with your host, Avenger Satanis, and the Beast.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Beast Zeno, and this is my co-host, Avenger Satanis. Avenger, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing good. And yourself?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Kind of looking forward
welcome
to today's show.
Yeah, me too. Should be good stuff.
Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead, man.
I just said smoke them if you got them, because I knew that you were having a cigarette.
Yeah, the irony of the cancer, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the man talks about the cancer of our society and things like that, and all the while he's puffing on one of those bad boys or... What are you smoking, Camels or Marlboros or?
Actually, I'm a Marlboro man, but since they're so expensive, I now smoke L&M's, which are pretty damn close, but a dollar cheaper per pack. So.
I suppose that adds up, yeah. But you're gonna be quitting pretty soon, right?
I intend to, maybe not entirely quit, but I intend to. To remove it as a necessity in my life and put it where it should be as just a luxury that is indulged in.
There you go. Yeah. So you're going to make that happen soon, right?
I intend to, yeah.
Okay.
Certainly do. July 4th is almost here and gone, and after that I can begin to focus on it. So.
Yeah. All right. You better. I'm going to hold you to that. And so is our audience.
Yes.
I hope.
Yes, I'm aware of the shirt.
They're only a few cigarettes a day.
Right. Well, my plan is to eventually get to where I'm only smoking when I want to, period.
There you go.
See, what happened, I went to try to quit a couple of years ago, and I came to realize this really strange kind of occurrence that takes place, and that is that I can't quit because I enjoy smoking.
Right.
So it's kind of like this paradoxical thing. Who the hell wants to stop something they like doing, you know?
Right.
You can try to logically justify it all you want in your own brain. It still comes down to, oh, but I really like that.
Right.
So.
But then you
got to
make a choice.
Sure. And my choice is pretty simple. It should be like alcohol or anything else is to me. And
right.
Something I only participate in when I choose to.
Right.
Not locked.
Not being a slave to a substance like an addict or something like that.
Right. Right. So that's definitely on my list of things to do. Of course, that list is forever getting longer and longer and longer. But
yeah. Hey, it's all about the multitasking.
Actually, I enjoy the concept of parallel processing more than multitasking.
Yeah, I know. We talked about that. All right, go ahead. Briefly share with us what the difference is between multitasking and parallel processing.
Well, parallel processing means that you develop a system in which you're integrating all the things that you're working on, where multitasking is more like dividing your attention individually to each item. And snapping back and forth between them.
Right.
So that's the long and short of it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I see the difference. Although on the other hand, I can see that it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. So, but I know what you mean. And that's very important, you know, to doing multiple things because there's so many things that we want to do. But going back to the whole quitting smoking or something else that you enjoy, that kind of goes along with a lot of fourth way ideas that, you know, there's some things that we like doing that we just got to stop, you know. We like, I don't know, we like complaining about our lives and we like it when there's, you know, needless drama and things going in that keep us busy and halt our progress and distract us. And, you know, we like to pity ourselves and we like to feel sorry for ourselves. And to some degree, we like it when we can't get everything we want, when our progress is shut down and we essentially fail. I think a lot of times, unconsciously, we're addicted to failure, and because we like it, you know, maybe because we've gotten so used to it, maybe because it's safe or it's more comfortable. It's the known rather than the unknown. You know, maybe it's adhering to what society or our closest friends or relatives think about us, and we don't want to disappoint their invisible expectations that we can sense, but maybe they don't come right out and say it. All that stuff, you know. We enjoy that. We enjoy suffering to a certain degree, but, you know, we got to divide ourselves up and say to ourselves, you know, part of me might enjoy the aspect of this or that, but overall it's no good for me, and I got to quit. I got to stop doing it, or at least way cut down and, you know, observe how I am when I'm in that state or when I'm wanting these things. And then from there we can change.
Right. Well, I think the fact is that we're never going to actually, we're never going to actually be able to completely differentiate ourselves from the suffering. So it becomes inevitable that, you know, you need to intentionally choose what you're willing to suffer and what's going to give you the best result because of it.
Right.
That's just
right.
My
yeah.
5 cents on it.
Right. Yeah. Right. People aren't going to be able to live on Easy Street 24/7. You know, have the cake and eat it too every day of their lives. That's very true. And conscious suffering is a big part of that. You know, you do something hard in order to benefit from something greater later on. You know, you delay instant gratification for the long range gifts that can be given.
Yeah, actually, I'm experiencing something like that in my own personal life right now. Well, I'm not going to get too much into the specifics of it, but I've chosen to take on a kind of suffering by acting in a certain way that's outside of my own natural state of being in order that I may, in the long run, maybe, you know, be fruitful from it. So,
well, that's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, isn't the story always about a girl, you know?
A lot of times. I'd say about 33% of the time, it's usually about a girl in one way or another.
Right. So, you know, the long and the short.
Yeah. Well, I think everybody has to do that, you know, shake things up and you know, put in the actual work in order to see the gains, you know, down the road. And, yeah, get out of your comfort zone and do something which, you know, may not be comfortable, but, you know, in the long run, it's good for you. It'll get you where you want to go. You can
Sure, and this actually brings us all the way full circle to what we're supposed to be talking about today. And that's the manifestation of things in objective reality.
Right. I was trying to kill time. I don't know if you noticed that until we had people calling in. Because we're supposed
to
have...
Well, we got Jason hanging out in the chat room, Sorrel, that is. King, I don't know if he'll be here or not. So it might just be you and me and by our lonesome, man. I think we don't have any issues tackling that, so.
Okay. You said that Jason Sorrell, Ego Diablos, he was in the chat room, or he's...
Yeah, he's hanging out in the chat room listening.
Okay. I didn't see the... I haven't loaded up the chat room. Hang on.
Yeah, and sign in as a co-host. There's a little box you switch there. That way you don't kick me out. Yep, you did it anyway. That's okay.
As you know, I'm kind of a... Well, sometimes a technological ignoramus. I just don't understand the technology. It just like... It seems counterintuitive to me. You know, there's a button that says start chat session. So, and it's green. So I click that, and then things happen, and it's like, whoops, fucked everything up. So, what, I was supposed to click on login chat as co-host? Is that it?
I already did it, so you were good just continuing. I closed out and came back.
I already left, so I don't know. Screw it. But anyway, hey, Ego Diabolus, our priest of Relay for the Cthulhu cult, if you want to call in, awesome. If you just want to listen in, that's cool too. Jason King or Zach from Satanic International, Dark Fool, or Pan's Hoof, or whoever the fuck else wants to call in today. Talk to us about objective reality. Awesome. If not, Beast and I will carry this biatch on our own.
That we will. So let's recap some things that I think that we discovered last week that really seem to kind of make sense in my eyes. First of all, I think that we came to the definition of objective reality as being everything that is not perceived by us, or everything that exists without our perception validating it. So it's a real...
We recognize that as one definition. I think by the end of last week's show, we kind of came to the conclusion that there was no definitive absolute definition for conscious or objective reality.
Sure, and that actually was leading into what I was saying, that because it is the absence of everything that we perceive, it by default has no real shape or form, and doesn't exist, at least not to us, perspectively.
Right.
So the next thing we came to, wait a minute, here comes Mr. Sorrell.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, you decided to join us.
Yeah, I just we were kind of listening to the chat room while we were making the kids lunch, and my girlfriend's sitting there. They're listening. They're watching a movie, so it could only really be me on the headphones. So as soon as we got everything situated, I jumped on the phone, and now she's in the chat room. So she's listening in as well. But I caught the beginning of it. So
we were struggling that hard.
No, not at all.
We were just discussing that objective reality doesn't really exist, at least not to us.
Right. So maybe it would behoove us to talk about, that is debatable, but maybe it would behoove us to talk about more subjective versions of objective reality, or some sort of objective reality that we can somehow put our finger on and either control or manipulate or talk about in realistic terms that we can interact with. I think that might be to everybody's benefit.
Right. That's what I agree with. I would say there is an objective reality, but it's not practical to always discuss trying to manipulate objective reality, because 9 times out of 10 you're going to fail Whereas if you're dealing with subjective reality, if you're dealing with things that are relative to handle, with the awareness that there are some things that just can't be changed, then you start focusing on the things that you can accomplish rather than the things that you might not be able to accomplish. So you don't want to set yourself up for a goal that's going to fail. So when you get into a subjective reality, dealing with your own perspectives, dealing with the perspectives of others, trying to deal with the rules and regulations and the systems in our society versus trying to change the fundamental fabric of reality, that just seems much easier to me.
Right. So maybe what we'll talk about this show is different types of subjective reality that are closer to what other people would say is, you know, what's really there. Or, you know, more of a solid form of subjective reality that, you know, it's not just you experiencing it, but maybe other people can confirm that, confirm or deny that as well. It's more, it's closer to consensual reality that other people's society might be able to look and say, oh, yeah, that's real, or that happened, or, you know, this is a phenomenon that we're experiencing, rather than just you, you know, visualizing Cthulhu as, like, I don't know, sitting on your couch or something, whereas that's extremely subjective. Whereas if you, you know, play the lottery and you win $10 and, you know, you spend it on suckers for you and some of your friends, that's closer to objective reality because other people can experience that. They can, you know, verify it and be like, oh, yeah, that actually happened. It's not just your own individual experience. It's other people's experience that are also subjective along with you.
I can give a really good example of that, that that's right in line with what you guys were starting out the show talking about with smoking. Okay. Right now, the legal age in most states to purchase cigarettes is 18. And that's created a social kind of perspective that anybody who smokes when they're younger than 18, well, they're doing something wrong. They're doing something that is distasteful. So it's distasteful to see a 13-year-old or a 10-year-old with a cigarette in their mouth, okay? But that's a social perspective. It's no more wrong for a 10-year-old to be smoking a cigarette than it is for a 50-year-old to be smoking a cigarette, other than the 50-year-old no longer has anybody responsible for them and for their own care, whereas the 10-year-old still has a couple of parents. If tomorrow the laws were to change, well, then society's perspective on what's the proper age for somebody to be smoking a cigarette, that would change as well over time as they adjusted to the new law. And that's a matter of subjective reality. It's not real, but it does define our behavior.
People,
one second,
along
guys,
with that, is also... Oh, go ahead.
We actually have another caller on the phone, so I figured I would let them come in the conversation before we got too far on.
Okay.
I believe this is... is this Mr. King?
That would be the case.
Awesome.
Hey.
What's up, guys?
What's up?
Ego? Not too much.
Ego, how you doing, man?
Good, man.
Oh, you know, same shit, man. Now, I've never talked to you, Ego, so Jason Sorrell.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of cool.
Either way, right on.
We got everyone in the house, man. We just got to get Zach here and fucking Dark Fool, and then we can have a fucking party.
That would be fun.
Blow it out, man.
That is probably closer to objective reality than anything that we've been talking about thus far.
Talking about Matt?
We can all agree on that. Yeah.
No, I'm talking about all of us being here in one spot.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. King. So give us your lowdown on objective reality.
Well, actually, I come from a school of thought that is influenced by Immanuel Kant in the Western schools, but also heavy Eastern mysticism, in that I don't see a dichotomy, a hard dichotomy between the two. In fact, I think they're poles of the same phenomenon. meaning that you can't have perception without having both poles. You can't have, you know, just subjective or just objective. They both exist together by necessity. You can't have an object with no subject perceiving it, and you can't have a subject with nothing to perceive. So you need both. And they exist in a continuum together. So to try to isolate one and say this is objective, or isolate the other and say this is subjective, is to kind of miss the whole point, which is that they work together. Yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming from anyway.
Okay. No, I like that. That works.
I think, honestly, I think we all inherently understand and agree with that. It's just when you're trying to, I don't know, particularly examine one end of the spectrum, you know, that's where you get tangled up and trying to figure out, you know, at which point does it begin to kind of blend into the other end of the spectrum.
Well, yeah. I think that's where the work comes in, too, with the, in my mind, the idea of trying to limit the expression of negative emotion. When you're expressing negative emotion, you're affecting your subjective reality. You're affecting the immediate, you know, your immediate perspectives based on that negative emotion. Whereas if you stifle it, basically, and then focus on the problem at hand, you're not dealing with the emotion. You're dealing with the issue. So you're manipulating what needs to be manipulated in reality, which is closer to the objective rather than your anger or your frustration or what have you, which is further away from that objective.
Yeah, I like that.
Interesting. I wish I had some big, long-winded speech all practiced up today for you gentlemen, but unfortunately I'm somewhat bankrupt, so don't mind me.
It's like you got four big dicks in the room, so who's going to fucking slap their shit down first is one of those kind of deals, I guess. I don't know.
Right. Well, usually in this kind of context, Beast and I, we kind of make way, so, you know, other people's penises get, like, a chance to shine, whereas, you know, our dicks hog the spotlight a lot, so we're like, you know what?
I'm only laughing because I've heard little stories about, never mind, your prowess and shit, dude, but anyway.
Yeah.
You are the man. I guess there's a reason you're the fucking high priest, dude.
I guess. I was just watching the South Park episode just a couple nights ago. It was an old one, I think. And it was about the Japanese making these weird toys that kids had, like, this big fad over. I think this was a few years ago. And they made these toys, and when you squeaked it, it said something like, "Down with capitalist America." And then one of the toy store owners, like, went to Japan and very realistically and complained about the fact that, like, hey, this is, like, anti-American propaganda. And they were like, oh, we have such small penis. Like, you have giant mammoth cock. Therefore, we are no threat to you. it's just funny.
Wasn't it George Carlin, too, who used to go on about how all wars, all conflicts on a global scale, it all comes down to who has the biggest dick? If you could just get the leaders of one country to meet with the leaders of the other country and just whip it out, and then, you know, come out of the private room and go, yep, the Russians won. Today they won. They're huge like that. That would take care of so much.
Yeah. I guess that would give new meaning to the concept of, like the people's champion. But anyway, getting on track, let me ask you guys a question. So if, for instance, some random person, say myself or the Beast or someone out there, wants to do something, you know, whatever it is, they want to change their life in some small but substantial way, is there, you know, a specific system of, like, getting to that point, or does it just completely depend on the random facts as they are in this person's life already? You know, is it dependent on emotional states or, you know, doing the groundwork and preparatory stuff, you know, preparing the space or preparing the way for all these changes to come? You know, is it more about exerting the will? You know, is it sort of like a magical interaction with reality in some way? Or is most shit just random and just kind of accidental?
I don't think there's really a key or a cheat code, if you will, to reality. I think everybody's going to approach it in their own way. I think it's a matter of if there's something you want to do, most people just do it. Whatever it is they want to do, they just do it. And if they don't do it, if for whatever reason they're telling themselves they want to do something or be something that they're not doing, either they don't want to really do it or they haven't adjusted their perspective enough to the point where they can actually accomplish it and go out and do it. So that would be the first thing, would be adjusting your perspective. Once you've adjusted your perspective, then it's a matter of convincing maybe other people to agree with your line of thinking so that whatever it is you want to manifest with a large enough group of people that it becomes real for the people you interact with. And then you just continue working on, you know, expanding that, you know, the idea is real and convincing enough people or convincing yourself repeatedly the idea is real until it no longer needs discussion. It exists.
Okay. I like that. King, do you have a response to that?
I think, you know, I agree pretty much with what was said, but, it's all about complexity. Everything is very complex, and there's randomness involved, too. Like you said, is it just pure chance? I mean, look at all these fucking reality shows that are out there now on TV that bother the fuck out of me, but that's just me. And it's like you got people in happenstance that are made famous for no reason whatsoever. So
right.
Can we say that they're manifesting or achieving or anything like that? Well, sure, from a certain perspective, they are. But it's only because other factors are working. So I don't even know how to explain this, really, but
what I'm saying is the
complexities of it are such that, you know, you can have the purest will and you can have the best drive in the world and fail, but you can have the most impure will and the most fail of character and yet thrive. And so how do you explain? Those would be like two, you know, poles
right.
of opposites, extremes that would not be explained by, you know, maybe a purely, quote-unquote, magical paradigm or what have you. Unless you understood
right.
it on a bigger scale, if you will. Which gets
right.
back to the whole subjective versus objective reality thing. Which is that we're not just... You know, one of the things that bothers me the most about, like, for example, Michael Aquino or whatever, and his philosophy is that he divides the world in two, and he says on this
right.
One hand you have, you know, the subjective universe, on this other hand you have the objective universe. So he views them in isolation, but they're not in isolation. They're in fact, they're holding hands. They're together. They're influencing each other, and they're bringing each other to different levels that cannot be seen if you look at either one in isolation. So it's kind of that same
truth. There doesn't seem to be a lot of shades of gray from my experience in the Temple of Set. It's more like, you know, there are people that are actually working and there are people that are half-assing it. You know, there are the, you know, the chosen few, and then there's the retarded majority. You know, there's, you know, there are the great works, and then there's, you know, just trash, and then it does seem very dualistic.
Well, I mean, we're having a conversation across like a several different levels, but what I think it's kind of gotten to now a little bit is something about success, like what defines success, like how would you define success. Like, you're talking about the second half of the equation, which is what is objective reality? That's the first half, and then the second half is, and how do you affect it? So how do you affect the object of reality? And then you look at some of the people that have been, like, I take Vincent van Gogh as a prime example of this, somebody that in his own life was not appreciated, but after the fact is just viewed as a genius artistically.
Right.
How would you rate him as a magician, Vincent van Gogh? Was he a success or a failure as a magician?
Right.
Well, during his life is one question, and then after his death is another. And, you know, that's kind of like life after death through the fulfillment of the ego, right?
Right, right. Yeah, that's the question.
I actually could throw a little bit of my perspective in here. Because what I believe is really going on here is at any one set time, you have this random set of influences which are working directly on the occurrence at hand. Now, you have this perceived idea of where you want to go with it, you know, what you want to manifest. And if you happen to understand each of these currents well enough to know which ones to be influenced by, then you have the opportunity to manifest within your own physical lifespan. However, I think all things that can happen do happen. And so that's why you see examples such as Van Gogh, where long after they're dead, they become appreciated. I gave
him as an extreme example, but I think if you look at pretty much everybody in history that's been influential on the ultimate level, like and mostly these are religious prophets and such, but they've been largely influential after their death. I mean, sure, some of them, like Muhammad is a prime example, were influential in their life. Muhammad obviously did some shit in his life. But he wasn't the capital P prophet until after he died. He just wasn't.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, I think we can all agree that the contestants, or whoever you want to call them, on the reality show Tool Academy, you know, or Rock of Love, Buck 2, probably are not going to be well-known after their death. They're probably not going to contribute something on a grand scale, you know, posthumously. But then you have Vincent van Gogh, and this example is going to come to no surprise to anyone, H.P. Lovecraft, who was fairly dismissed far and wide during his life. But afterwards, you know, obviously there was an explosion, and the Cthulhu mythos is like an actual thing in popular culture, and people know about it. So,
that's exactly the dichotomy I was honing in on.
Yeah. However, there are some individuals, I suppose, very rare, like outspokenly magical individuals, like, say, Aleister Crowley, who are probably well known and popular and have something to contribute to the scene or culture or society during their life and after their life. And maybe to a certain degree, Lovecraft is like that too, because he did have a fan base, however small. You know, weird tales writers and astounding stories, you know, fans that wrote in and other contemporary writers that used some of his elements like the Necronomicon and such in their writing. So I think ultimately, isn't that the goal, that we want to be, you know, recognized and achieve things in our life and after our death?
Getting back to the question of success, and especially with Van Gogh and to a lesser degree Lovecraft, Van Gogh, having studied him in art school, he wanted to paint. So as long as he had money to pay for his paints, he, as far as he was concerned, was successful. The idea of selling a painting or, you know, becoming known for his painting is secondary. That's an external influence. And, of course, he was concerned about it. He's concerned about it because he's living with his brother and his brother's wife, and they were like, you know, you need to go out and get a job. And he's like, oh, I want to paint. And if it means I have to sell my paintings to keep you off my back, then, you know, I'm going to try to sell my paintings and be frustrated if it doesn't work out. But as long as he was painting, I mean, he'd rather paint than have food. He'd rather paint than have a roof over his head. So for him, success was just being able to paint. And I think for a lot of people, that's sufficient. Whatever it is they like doing, whatever it is they pursue, as long as they can pursue it, that's successful to them. Now, how society measures success after that, I mean, it's all fine and good, but I think Van Gogh would be like, who gives a shit?
Right, and no,
I totally agree. I think that's kind of the point that I was making, is that, you know, most of your savants throughout history have had that attitude, whereas they're devoted to their art to the extent where, in art, I'm using that in a wider sense, obviously, they don't really care what the societal measure of that is. And that's why they're great. It's because they have that single-minded vision. Once you kind of get away from that. Now, granted, in today's day and age, we have somebody like a Bill Gates, who I think would probably, I use him as an example a lot when I'm talking, would be somebody that would fulfill both of those categories that we've been talking about success in the here and now, and then also success after his life. Obviously, he's going to have both. But I don't think he really cares about his success in the here and now. It's more of a visionary. He's a visionary mentality or person. And it's just kind of accidental now that we live in an age that you have this global technology and everything else where he can be made rich off being an idealist. You didn't have that back in the Middle Ages or whatever. So,
right.
That's very true. Now,
I think this all actually leads into what I was saying, which is that these people have chosen the correct influences in what they're doing. They're doing it for the love of what they're doing, they're feeding into the actual drive of wanting to create rather than wanting to be successful, which I think are two different things.
Right. Totally. You mean being successful in the commercial sense or like a mainstream being recognized?
Right. Well, they're doing it without the notion that somebody's going to stop and recognize what they're doing. They're doing it with the notion that this is what they're here for, this is their purpose, this is, you know, the only thing that matters to them, and it's what drives them towards this end result. That is falling into the right influences, and it's why they can manifest both during their physical life and then afterwards.
So is that a disregard for anything except their own subjective reality? Is that a rejection of any kind of multiple subjective reality or consensual reality or objective reality? You know, they're only creatively obsessive about what they're doing and their own small effect on the world or the medium that they're using, and then everything else can go to hell. Is that the most effective means of
honestly, my view on that is that it's subjective and objective reality are inconsequential to them because their focus is so extremely just on this one narrow perspective. That's the magic of it, that their will is only moving within that one particular confined current.
In other words, if I can build on that, they're non-dual, which is exactly
correct.
What I was saying before. When we start like categorizing things into subjective and objective and say this is objective reality or subjective reality, we're kind of missing the point. They both exist together, and we want to ask questions about one pole or the other pole. We're missing the point. They don't exist in isolation. They can't exist in isolation by definition, so... Once you become ignorant, and I mean ignorant in a good way, once you become ignorant of that fact, that there do exist two poles, then you can start going about the business of manifesting.
So would you lean towards, I guess, three poles, or are you kind of leaning towards, like, there are no sides, or there are no poles?
No, there are two. We conceive of two different poles. So they must be real. Because we conceive of them, they must be real. The question is, to what extent are they real and how do they affect everything?
I actually have a larger theory on that.
Go ahead,
I'm sorry. Please.
No, it'd be great to share it, dude.
All right, my larger theory is this. Because a division is originally made. Like, instead of objective and subjective reality, the whole of it is reality. Because the division is initially made between objective and subjective reality, then from there, it can do nothing but continue to divide. You can have subjective-objective reality, you can have objective-subjective reality, and it can just keep dividing along that way because the division has been made.
Actually, I look at it completely differently. What I look at it like is kind of like this. In mathematics, you have what are known as units. Units is the number one, basically. So if you measure something off against units, you're always measuring specific units of any number. But the entire number system is based on being able to measure. So you always have to have units. Units, meaning the number one, would be the subject of perception. Everything is measured off against the subject of any perception, which is why you can have multiple subjects in any given reality. For example, the reality we all persist in, there are four subjects having this conversation right now. There are four units. Each one of us measures off a set of measurements that is our reality that we term individually reality. But they're connected in the sense that they're part of the same larger set that we call the universe, for example.
Right.
And then that's part of a larger set that we call the multiverse, et cetera. So
I think we're talking about the same thing.
No, I agree. That's why I said to build on it, just because I don't, you know, necessarily think that, what were you saying, actually?
What I was saying was that because one division is made, it can continuously be divided.
Well, yeah, then you're getting, yeah, that's right. You were talking about a subjective, objective, objective, subjective. I think that's kind of like you're falling into a pit there. If you want to keep going in that route, you know what I mean? And we can fall into pits of reason all we want, because reason does that. Reason has, these are what Kant called the antinomies, which is like where you can prove, you know, the opposite things by the same use of reason. You can prove that God exists or that he doesn't exist or whatever you want to prove, just based on the pure use of reason.
Sure.
Because that's kind of the
sure.
way our mind works, you know what I mean?
I do, and that was the point I was kind of making as well, is that because the division is made at all, it can continue to be divided.
Well, it can, but then
the point of it is that that's where the breakdown happens and where you can no longer manifest. That's the point. When you begin to divide these things and you begin to move away from that singular focus, and that's
right. I guess you can
point
keep tearing things down to like their subatomic particles, but that.
I agree with Jason King's point on this. Is that there? When we talk about subjective and objective reality, well, we're just talking about, these are just words we're trying to use to describe an idea. But they're really, there's an ebb and flow between the two poles. It's either more real or less real in a subjective manner, and there's an ultimate reality which is objective, and then there's truly fantastical, which would be subjective, just a matter of perspective in the mind. And it's working within that ebb and flow that results in manifestation, and that's where the rubber hits the road. That's where it becomes practical. It's different levels of influence and deciding what level of influence for you defines success. And if it's just a matter of you seeing it a certain way and not caring what everybody else says, well, then that's success for you. But if it's a matter of I've got to change the world politic, or I've got to change everybody's mode of thinking, well, then success takes achieving a higher or closer rate of agreement in objective reality, or a higher level subjective reality that's closer to that objective reality.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Very, very, very well said. Much, much better said than I said it.
I think everybody's contributing to stuff.
That's why this guy's writing my next book for me. I'm paying him under the table, and he's going to write it for me. Fuck it.
No, to me that seems more of an organic occurrence. the way that you guys are describing things seems to be an organic expression of the mechanical function I'm describing. I think that we're talking about the same thing.
At least what I'm saying is that these ideas that we have, subjective and objective, those are qualities of our mind. Those are things that we impart to reality that is what it is. It is non-dual. It is what it is.
Right.
It is suchness. We categorize it because we are what we are. We are siphon fields over the totality. We're limiting fields, or we're conscious. I have a lot of different terms for it, but you either get what I'm saying or you don't. We're like, we capture a part of reality, we put it in a box, and because we put it in a certain box a certain way, then we have these labels now, subjective, objective, the unit and the measured against the unit. Like if I say pi is 3.14159265 whatever, I'm saying that's measured off against what? The number one. Always. Everything is measured off against the number one.
Right.
So
I mean, yeah, reality, we could just say that, you know, instead of a duality, there are five poles, you know, all the time. And, you know, we have to rearrange the facts or rearrange our thinking about things until we come up with this division of five. But that's only because we arbitrarily said, "Oh, let's see things in five terms rather than in two terms, like black and white, good and evil, yes and no, binary language." I like to think of things in threes because I think that's just easier. Because the human mind can only, you know, conceive of so many things at one time in sort of a complex, I don't know, concept or paradigm or universe. You know, it would be hard to think of like 90 different poles at the same time of everything working like on 90 different sides. That would be very difficult. So usually people break it down into two, because that's really, I mean, you can't just have one, because then everything would just be one big whole. It would just be one big holistic, you know, everything is a part of everything else, and there's no divisions. So what people do, I think, is they do what's easiest, and that's to break things down into two. You know, you want to go here, you want to go there. You know, are you going to be awake, are you going to be asleep? Is it day, is it night? But then if you get into deeper thinking, you get into more of the shades of gray, the third side, things like that, then you're like, well, you know, it's twilight, or it's dusk, or it's maybe. And I think that's better for, you know, people like us to see things in terms and stuff like that. But a lot of people, no matter how you couch it, they're just going to want to see things in terms of two, you know. Is this right, or is this wrong?
Would you say there is some empirical basis for that division? It would be called duality. I mean, the dualistic approach that's been with humanity since the beginning. And Hermeticism has obviously taken it to the fucking extreme, but I mean, is there some basis in reality for that, for dualism?
I think that it's the natural occurrence of things. I'd say that by default there has to be that basis in reality of it.
Of course,
as soon as you start dividing, two is the first logical step, dividing things into two, and then from there you can divide things into three and four and five. So I think.
But okay, we divide the world into subject and object, and where's the third? What are we going to insert there in the middle, or on the
outside? Well, I like what someone said. I can't remember, but I think it was like limited objective, or like multiple subjective reality, like somewhere in between. I think that would be the third side, in this case.
Would it just be a different set of dualities? I think what you're talking about is like you have different subjects and they all have their own objective reality, right?
Or you have your scale. You have your objective and subjective, but you recognize that they are one thing. So your three points of reference then are then the one thing, and then one extreme of that scale, and then the other extreme of that scale. So you have You have the 2 points, and the scale itself would be your 3 points of reference.
Right.
But they're not, points on the same footing, though. Because one would be an understanding that the other two were kind of a false dichotomy.
Right.
Yeah, I can
so then that wouldn't be a genuine triple. It wouldn't be like the strong force in physics where there's a genuine, like a tripolarity there. There's a genuine tripolarity in the strong force. That wouldn't be the same kind of thing you're talking about.
But can you right, make sure. It that way? Can you massage the answer? To make it three poles, to make it.
I prefer
dichotomy.
To massage breasts, but no, I'm just kidding.
Well, hey, there's two breasts, so I can't fault you there. Your logic.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Is it the duality is kind of built into our structure? Even it's built into our, you know, we are, you know, we have a symmetry a certain way, and it's a twofold symmetry,
right.
Left and right.
But so
we're
is
not
the,
symmetrical.
So is the, So is the unit, though, like you were talking about, the monotheism of the cock. That hopefully someone's writing this down.
It's
really good stuff.
I said something like this in the forum when they were talking about duality and, you know, how we need to get rid of duality. It's like, yeah, you can talk all day long about getting rid of duality, but at the end of the day, duality is the thing that's going to come back and kick your ass because there is
right.
going to be the way you deal with things outside of yourself is to divide things into their opposites, plus and minus, you know, whatever, male and female, whatever. And it is, I mean, it is a simplistic view, whereas the more complex view is going, no, there's a hole there, and there's grades between the two, and that kind of view. So trying to get away from duality is it's an interesting path to go down if you can go down it, but at the end of the day it's still there.
You know what I mean?
Now guys, there's actually there is one thing that I think intersects this number line, and that intersection is our perception, ourselves, the actual act of perceiving. That's where it becomes perpendicular and it intersects at any point within that duality. It is a third pole by default. It's a third pole.
It's not actually a pole.
Well,
it wouldn't be.
Yeah, I don't think it's a pole. It's just like
it would be an instant or a point instant or something like that.
Yeah, it would be the reference. Yeah, reference point. It would be a key or a map. Of
what I wanted to say, when Ego said something, I wanted to build on this real quick just because, you know, I don't want to lose the train of thought. But he was talking about, you know, polarity. And what I've wondered about sometimes is why we build our mathematics around, you know, like you have the positive and negative, and then when you even get into imaginary numbers and complex numbers and hyper-complex numbers, there's always that duality. There's always the positive plus I, minus I, everything else. It is possible, though, to build a mathematical system that would have three poles in which neither any two poles would cancel each other out, but when you added all three together, they would equal zero. So instead of plus one, minus one equals zero, you would have, like, a blue, a red, and a green one, and then when you put all those together, you got zero. And then if you added any two together, you'd get something else entirely. And this is kind of like what, like I was saying before, the strong force is built around. That kind of tripolarity. We only discovered that empirically, but what I'm saying is why did we build our entire system around this, you know, two-poled view of the world? It is ingrained. I totally agree. You can't get around it. There's something about the world that is dualistic, whatever that might be, that we can't get around.
I think it's just easy. I think it's the path of least resistance, and that's why
exactly
90% of people accept it as, you know, that's what life is. Life is dualistic. Life is a dichotomy. You know, there's two poles pretty much all the time, and it's either one thing or it's the other. I think it's just, I don't want to get too pejorative, but I think it's lazy and sloppy thinking a lot of times, maybe not all the time, and sometimes it's very healthy to think it's dualistic terms. But I think it's not necessary. I think reality, or our view of reality, would be a lot more interesting and a lot more effective if we could see it in sort of a tripolarity or a trichotomy. But that's just my opinion.
And a system that would be outside the number scale is exactly the kind of thing you're saying when you mentioned color. When you take two colors and put them together, you're going to get something else. But when you start adding multiples of color, you get to a black, no matter what. It always goes to black. And it's going to get more and more brown or what have you. So a system like that does exist, but a system like that would be so complex that it would be harder to wrap the mind around. I mean, mathematics is complex enough. It can be complex enough. But if we got into like a color scale system like you were talking about, where you have a definitive blue and a definitive yellow, and you put the two together, you get a green. And if you were to throw in a red, well, that's what you get towards a black. You could have a system of thinking for that, a system of reference. I don't have the scope of mind to participate in that system.
No, I think none of us do, and I think that's kind of the point. There was, I think somebody said once, and I forget who the fuck this was because I'm a little too far gone, but it's something about N-1 geometries where it's like you have so many dimensions that you can perceive and then, this is what it goes to, gravity. For example, gravity follows the inverse square law, not the inverse cube law or anything like that, and we exist in three spatial dimensions. So the question is, why do we exist in three spatial dimensions and yet gravity follows the inverse square law, which is N-1? Why does that happen? You know what I mean? So I kind of think that this is referential, I think, a lot to where we stand in the fractal expression. We're kind of bent into space-time at a certain level, and it's a low level. It's actually not the lowest level, but it's the next to lowest level.
Wow, you know, that sounds a lot like the rate of creation and the whole level of octaves and that stuff in the fourth way. I don't know if you've ever made that correlation, but that we're so far down, like Earth, on the scale of cosmic, the octave in the ray of creation, that, you know, the only point that's lower than us, I guess, would be the moon, from that Gurdjieff teaching perspective. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that particular formulation, but, you know, if there's parallels, I guess two guys are going to hit the same, or never mind, whatever that quote was. A broken watch is right twice a day. Yeah, that's it. That's the quote. No, but seriously,
well, I'm going to go on record saying that I would approve going to a color-based system rather than a number-based system. Because as fucked up as that sounds, I think that would be easier for me to get a handle on than numbers. Because I've always had trouble with numbers, and math just doesn't like me, and I don't like it. And I think arranging things in colors and determining things like that would be easier for me. So I'm all for that, but I know that would probably fuck up the rest of the world. So
no, it probably wouldn't, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, the guy that proved Fermat's last theorem might have used a system similar to that to prove it.
Oh, really?
All right.
That's cool.
I'm not entirely sure about that, but...
Real quick, I would actually suggest that it would probably even be better footing to base it on shades rather than colors or numbers, because it works with both that way.
Shades? Shades of color?
Shades.
Or...
Yeah, shades of color. Shades
okay.
of color.
Why we're talking about a continuum, and in any case, we're talking
shade.
About a continuum.
What's
right.
that?
We're talking about a continuum, in any case.
Right.
The funny thing
yeah.
about this whole thing is colors are numbers. If you look at it from a certain perspective, they are numbers. We can give a specific number to every color in the rainbow. You know,
yeah,
in the...
of light.
That actually ties a lot into this frequency research that I've been doing, but we're about out of time, guys, so about 30 seconds. Do we want to do a part 3? or
part three, motherfucker.
All right, let's keep it going.
All right, part three
way,
next week then.
Green is number one.
All right.
Well, thanks guys for being on the show. Let's try to do part three next week, and hopefully have you both on.
I'll be there.
Right on.
And like I said, I'm
all
a
right.
man of my word, so if I say I'm going to be there, Beast, I told you I was going to be here, and I was here, man.
I know, man.
That's the way I roll, dude.
That's good, man.
You roll well.
All right. Well, guys, the show's way over, so thank you both for coming out. I really appreciate both of your perspectives, as well as yours, of course, Venger. It's interesting to kind of hear my same thoughts echoing in different manifestations.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, we're just a manifestation of TC's mind. That's all we are.
That's the way I've worked it out, guys.
That's all we'll ever be. Hey, that's good enough.
All right. Have a good day.
I really get going. Yep.
All right.
See you guys.
Later.